Hello again, this is Dolores Cannon with the Metaphysical Hour. And we're going live again tonight, you know, because when I'm not here, we use the shows out of the archives. This is a live show tonight. And I thought when I got back from Russia, I was going to be able to stay home for a little while, but it didn't work out like that. I got a call from the History Channel, and so I had to fly to Boston to do a filming for that. So it was in and out. So even when I think I've got time off, I really don't have time off. All right. But anyway, tonight we have a very interesting guest, and he's in Alaska. And this is Nick Magic. I'm sorry, Nick. I just cannot pronounce your last name right.
It's Begich. That's fine, Dolores. I know it's one of those names that just ties people's tongues up sometimes.
The main thing is I'm not insulting you, but I just can't quite get it right.
That's all right.
Okay, well, Nick is, we've known each other for a long time, and he's been on my show before, and he's in Alaska. What's the weather like up there?
Well, it's probably not much different than what you had in Russia a week or so ago. We still got quite a bit of snow on the ground. I mean, our days are getting longer, but we're like right at freezing today, so it's sort of half melting and half freezing out there today.
So spring has not yet arrived in Alaska.
No, it's another month away probably for us here, or at least what most people would consider spring. Pretty short season, spring and fall. The summer's short enough, and the winter's what takes up the time up here.
Well, here in Arkansas, it's been like in the 70s today, but in another day or so, we're supposed to have freezing and snow, so it hasn't quite settled down here yet either.
Yep, there you go.
Oh, well, but you know, the weather is so weird all over the world anyway. Okay, but Nick has written many books, and many of them are very controversial books, really, but that's what you're into, isn't it?
Yeah, you know, we've covered mostly technologies, and of course some of those can be pretty controversial. And over the years, last 15 years or so, we've been covering some of those stories.
Yeah, because I remember when I had you on before, we talked about the HARP project, and that
right.
was very big then, and I still think it is very important out there. But you've written a lot of more books since then, haven't you?
Right. We did the story, Gene Manning and I, on HARP, co-authored the book Angels Don't Play This HARP, back in 95,
yeah.
which, you know, continues to make news coverage. In fact, Wired magazine is going to be coming out with a story on HARP in one of its upcoming issues. They interviewed us for some time ago. But a lot of other areas. We cover privacy-related technologies, some of the underwater sonars we've covered over the years, cell phones, some of the more innovative technologies as it relates to improving human performance, and then so on the sinister side of that, those things that interfere with human performance, what used to be and often is referred to as mind-altering or mind-effects technology.
Yeah, and I remember back in when you came out with the HARP, you were the ones that were blowing the whistle on all of this.
Right.
It was all definitely undercover.
Right, and you know, those things continue, you know, and what we found over the years is that from administration to administration, the programs tend to, you know, continue, and unfortunately, in these areas today, particularly, the invasiveness of these technologies is so incredible. It's nothing like it was, you know, people thought about privacy, you know, 20, 30 years ago, it kind of began and ended with our front door, and today, so much of who we are and what we are is stored somewhere, and at the same time, the ability to interpret who and what we are is becoming more and more sophisticated, even to the point where emotional states can readily be discerned from a distance just based on the way brain activity can be measured. They're getting even more sophisticated in those areas for security reasons and other reasons is always the excuse, but nonetheless, some pretty incredible things are happening, even in the more refined areas of neuroscience, where interpreting literally thoughts is one of the things that is on the near-term horizon.
Okay, before we go any further, let me give out the toll-free number in case anyone wants to call in while we're on the air. Okay, the toll-free number is 877-876-5227. 877-876-5227. Yeah, I think all of this is very interesting because I know the way the internet and the computers, everything is just changing and growing so fast that it's mind-boggling. We can't keep up with it. And you're saying it's gone beyond
the amount. Absolutely, yeah. And it's driving everything else. You know, when you start thinking about computer advances and the idea of being able to run calculations faster and faster. I mean, just in our lifetimes, what used to fill up a pretty good sized office building, you know, you can pretty much fit into a watch. pretty amazing jump. And we're going to see that same kind of jump in the next 7 to 10 years in terms of density and capability as the various areas of science continue to advance and really converge into what's becoming more and more integrated just because of the computing systems, information systems, and the ability of people to just communicate with one another.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I've noticed it just in the computers because, you know, we've gone away from the disks and we were into the zip drives, and I thought that was really something until I got a new computer a few years ago, and they said, no, you don't need zip drives anymore. It's just these little, I call them the little thingamajigs. You know, they're the little Walkman. I say it's thingamajig. That it's amazing, and even those are getting tinier and tinier.
Where, yeah, you know, and you I plug think that. Yeah.
You know what I'm, you plug them in, and, well, one of those will, in my publishing business, will hold 5 books or more.
Right, the little drives that you can just plug into plug in and out of your computers. And again, you know, things that were thought to have to be big, bulky, and huge in terms of storage, is continuing to change. But when you look at the human brain, it's pretty complicated, in fact, very complicated, just in order to, measure one neuron firing chain within the human brain, it takes, 3 supercomputers that are calculating at a rate that would be the equivalent of all the people on the planet with hand calculators every 5 seconds for 60 hours running a calculation. One of these supercomputers does the same thing in 1 second. Now, three of those together can measure a neuron firing chain in the human brain in 3 dimensions and map it, which is then you can also feed that same kind of signal back into another brain and, you know, sort of see what happens. And this is a kind of experimentation that is going on, but the advent of the next wave of computers, which are going to be quantum computers, these calculate at even a more phenomenal rate. Now think about 1 second of that supercomputer I just described, all those billions of people for 60 hours every 5 seconds doing that calculation in 1 second. Now imagine that computer running for 1 trillion years and a supercomputer, the quantum computers of the future in our lifetimes will do that in 1 hour. What a supercomputer today does in 1 trillion years, that kind of calculating allows you to interpret then whole brain activity and be able to start to not only map, but feed signals back and recreate complete scenarios, complete learning experiences, or otherwise memory sets. And that's sort of the desired goal when you start to read some of the military literature and some of the neuroscience in this area. That's where we're headed as our computing power and capability increases.
You know, you said earlier about that they would be able to track us through the neutrons in the brain and our thought waves.
Well, every person has a unique electromagnetic signature. It's as unique as your thumbprint, and it just requires a high enough resolution reading technology to be able to discern that one from another, and the ability to compute that, you know, when you start looking at people over, you know, large areas. And, you know, they have things like, just features-wise, they have facial recognition systems, these surface kind of things that are represent some pretty complicated software. But reading a person's, say, thermal signature, and on your face, if you read a thermal print, those are all unique to individuals. So there's, you know, there's a lot of ways to sort of look at and track an individual. Through the wall, through the ground, you can discern temperature differentials of a fraction of a degree, and you can determine, like, what's an engine, what's a human, what's a mouse, you know, all these kinds of things. But that resolution, if you will, the clarity in which you see the image, is becoming better and better as our technology improves. And I guess that's a really good way to sort of look at all of this technology. The higher the technology, the better the resolution in terms of tracking your population or individuals within it or anything else within, you know, within society. I mean, think about...
In my work, that's what I've been finding. They said everyone has their own frequency and vibration, and it's all
sure.
different.
So
that's
sure.
what you're talking
about. Exactly. It's the same language, just a different set of words. Same thing. You bet.
Yeah. Okay, but that was the way we all are different. We think we're alike. But there is, they said, there's nothing really alike in the whole world anyway. Or
that's
in the universe.
Correct. That's
but
correct.
Then,
I mean, if you think...
Our frequency and vibration, then they're able to pick up on that and identify us from that. That's what you mean, isn't it?
It is indeed. In fact, not only that, but as we gain an understanding, I mean, I think this is also sort of that two-edged sword, you know, as we gain an understanding of what we are as human beings, and we also learn something about manipulating that on our own, that's one thing. But we're talking about technologies on a very invasive level penetrate the very essence of who we are. And then when you start to think about that, if you can model certain things, you can then create experience sets. And this is what military has been after for many, many decades and have been successful. In fact, the book we wrote, Controlling the Human Mind, broke this down with over 250 source documents showing sort of the evolution of the technology and explaining sort of how it works. But in very clear terms, what has happened is our technology now is maybe overtaking our good sense. I mean, in terms of how we develop it and how we use it, because we're getting into areas now that challenge the very baseline values that most people share in common. And that's at the same time the technologies are becoming more and more suppressed or secret for national security and other reasons, at a time when we really ought to be having some serious discussion about the implications of these technologies in this century.
Yeah, that is a little scary. That means that you would never really be, you couldn't hide anywhere then. If they had, rather like having your fingerprints, but you couldn't hide anywhere. They would be able to find your frequency. Like you said, I'm saying it simply, but they would be able to track that no matter where you were.
That's right. And in fact, even your voice is so unique. It's like your thumbprint. And within the first few seconds of a telephone call, you can discern who a person is if you have the right software and that basic information is stored. Eventually, we're going to see our telephones where you pick them up from anywhere in the world. You know, there's billions of telephones around. You pick it up and you start talking and you say, hello, I want to call so-and-so in Cincinnati. And the machine is going to recognize your voice, who you are, who the person is in Cincinnati, and your dialing patterns, and it's going to say, certainly, Mr. Begich, we'll get right on it. And boom, your call is going to be put through, and it's going to be billed to your home phone number. And it's going
to
be based on a voice recognition system.
That's like the computer comes up and says, hello, Dolores, you know. And I get all these emails. I said, how do they know that I've contacted these other places?
This is even more invasive when you consider, just consider the fact that your voice is that unique. But at the same time, we'll consider it convenient. Other things that are already happening, your cell phone, uniquely, your unique phone number. What most people don't realize is it has GPS built in, so every time you make a call, who you called, when you called, and where you were when you made the call is stored. Because it triangulates off of the antennas that rebroadcast the cell phone signal and give you really good triangulation. And so they store all that as part of the system these days. And then when you're walking down the road and you pass the billboard that's automated, at some point it's going to be tagged to you, so it'll know something about you and what you're going to be interested in. And the sales pitch is going to be more personally oriented. And that's going to happen in most of our lifetimes.
Well, that really is Big Brother coming to life, really.
It is.
But, when we've gone to these foreign countries, my daughter has cell phones now that will work in these other countries, and it knows when you get into a different time zone, and it came up on the cell phone, hello, welcome to Russia or welcome to England. So it does know where you are.
Right. And, we think of it, we don't really think much about that, but think about all the transactions in your life now that are digitized and stored somewhere virtually indefinitely, because that data is valuable. What they have developed is an industry where data valence, the analysis through complicated computer programs of data, so that they can literally footprint a person in a way that they know what kind of political pitches to put their way. They know what kind of advertising they're most likely to respond to. And the more sophisticated these systems get, and the cheaper it is to store data, as we were talking earlier about how small these storage devices are and how much you can store on them, well, it also represents how cheap it is to keep a lot of information, so why throw it away? And it turns out that if you can organize that information, the systems to do that are getting better and better. Think about searching the web like we do right now against word searches. Imagine with voice information, when it all gets digitized and loaded on the web, everything you've ever said anywhere can be searched instantly, just like you're searching the internet. And that's where all this technology takes us, which maybe isn't a bad thing, but you know, some of us feel like certain presumptions of privacy are okay to have in an organized society, and this strips it away pretty foundationally, these technologies.
Yeah, but it does sound like Big Brother, doesn't it? It's getting to that point.
It is, and it becomes highly manipulative because, you know, data you can do a lot with, and when you start to think about how to construct persuasive arguments, they're no longer about that. It's how to sell something to someone by pitching them just what they want to hear and they're going to resonate with. And that's what this kind of sophisticated data-based development eventually leads to. So you never get sort of the whole story so you can make a prudent decision, whether it be a political debate or something else. You'll just get very directed sound bites and information that moves you a certain direction, and that's where the danger lies, because free-flowing information is one thing, but when that information is manipulated to persuade or to manipulate an individual into doing something, we really need to start to analyze the technology, because it's not just as simple as it used to be. It's become quite invasive, and the directions in which it's headed, you know, with our own funding through our tax dollars, is a direction that leads to a more controlled and directed society. Big Brother becomes, you know, a concept that is fully appreciated at that stage of the game, and everything is over in terms of personal liberty.
Well, that's one thing I recognize with commercials and things, because, you know, in my line of work with hypnosis, I know they are planting subliminal suggestions on a different level, and people don't realize that. So it's along that line. You're talking about influence.
You bet. You can do that now with technologies that feed into our lives every day. Anything that carries an electromagnetic signal from an internet connection, a television show, radio, the power grid itself can be manipulated. In fact, we documented this pretty thoroughly in the book Controlling the Human Mind, where you can actually manipulate any of these carriers, and anyone within the range of one of these carriers could be influenced. And about 70% of the population ends up being affected by systems like this. And why it's 70% and 30% aren't, I think has a whole lot to do with, you know, who those individuals are and perhaps what other fields around them might be stronger than the ones they're trying to use to influence. But these things have been documented going back to the 1960s. As the science advanced in the 80s and 90s, they got even more sophisticated. In fact, the U.S. Army and U.S. Air Force, U.S. Navy, they all have programs in this area that have been reported on, you know, from time to time. And when you look at the way in which a lot of these have been compartmentalized and the things that they're discovering about human potentials, it has a lot more to do with just storing information. I mean, I think part of it that shows up in the literature is sort of these anomalous capabilities that human beings from time to time demonstrate. Things that we used to call ESP, they call it an anomalous human performance today in some of the literature, which, you know, we laugh about it, but, you know, it's true. It's what people couldn't explain, they're now starting to figure out and be able to explain. They got to give it a new name because the old name has all kinds of connotations attached to it.
Yeah. But I think, and it is a little scary, though, when you think that you don't have any privacy at all whenever you look at it that way.
I think it's important. Important for us to recognize, you know, that, and, you know, the last administration, you know, brought us a lot of that. I hope this one takes and we gain some ground back, because you know, it is a dangerous world, but we've given up an awful lot for what we think might be security.
Yeah, that's the thing. But, you know, you were talking about it being able to recognize all our voices. What about these technologies they have for, you know, electronically disguising the voice and altering the voice?
It's the same kind of idea, only you could synthesize a voice. Because once you lay down the pattern and you can interpret the signal, you can create a signal that will duplicate it. And that gives you the ability to perfectly mimic someone else.
But I mean to disguise your voice if you use this technology that alters the sound of the voice.
Oh yeah, and that's readily available. That's used in all over the place for exactly that. And whether it's and it's just creating an electronic signal to just buffer it in a specific way.
I mean, would that be able to fool these systems if it would alter your voice?
I think again, signal analysis is what a lot of science is about. So sort of reversing that and looking at it in a different way. I suppose you could scramble it. If you did it randomly, but even random, any sort of pattern to that would be, I think you could undo just as easily as you could create it. So I don't know how good those systems are ultimately.
I was thinking, you know, some people might try to use something to get around it if they did want to keep from being identified anyway.
Sure. Yeah, I think that's true. And, you know, when you think about just how much is put into these areas of research, there's certain levels of science get available to the general public. Other levels of science sort of are held back for a long time. When you think about even the computers we use today, a lot of the materials, a lot of the ideas that have been used in modern technologies were at one time classified. They become declassified sort of as use proliferates and the classification weans or better technologies replace them. But many of the technologies we rely on today started out as classified programs and brought us some pretty interesting innovations, but 20 years from the time they were discovered.
Well, you know, when my Nostradamus books first came out, it's been 20 years ago now, and the computers had just been developed. So I got my first one in 1985, and
right.
In those books, we were discussing, Nostradamus was discussing the advancement of computers. And I thought at the time, oh, yeah, in 100 years. But the things he was describing I've seen happen in 10 years. He said at first it would be, normal computers. And then they would be activated by voice. And, you know, that is becoming. And then they said they would be activated by thought. And this sounds kind of like where you're going.
Well, and that's true. I think that is where they're at. And where we're headed at a real rapid rate.
I know the one I found since I've been doing my work that in Japan, that a few years ago, they did develop the kind that you could just think at it and make things turn on and off in motors and things. It's supposed to be for the handicapped.
They're also using them in advanced aircraft through eye movement, through thought measurement for a more rapid and instant response. And as a trend, this is where it is headed, where all of that data, and then you got to think about it. Now you literally, when you reach that stage, like from the keyboard, that's how you're connected to the system. From the eyes, you know, you're connected to the system. You know, so you can see, you know, sort of how that would work by tracking eye movement and so on. But when you literally hardwire yourself or connect to the machine through the mind, where the mind's interactions are interpreted, understood, and transmitted and recorded, then we have a very different situation than the one we have presently. And this is where, again, we need to be careful, because there is no regulation in these areas, and there should be significant regulation in these areas, because any carrier that can be used to carry a signal out can be used to carry a signal in. And again, the resolution is important, because the better we get at this, first voice recognition, which is sort of a connection, it's your vocal cords create a vibration, that vibration hits the machine interprets the vibration and understands the word. Well, that's your connection substituting for the hands, and the resolution becomes finer. Now you connect to the brain, the resolution has to take a very big leap in computing power to get that resolution, but once had, signals travel both ways. This, without regulation, will be a very, very dangerous time for humanity.
Well, I know when I was studying this, about what the Japanese had discovered by using thought, They said the amazing thing was that it didn't matter what language the person spoke, that, you know, the machine would understand the command because it was the thought that was triggering it, not the language. And that's amazing.
Yeah. Well, I think that's kind of tells us a lot about communications in terms of the universality of what parts of the brain are affected by specific ideas. But what is a thought anyway? You know, a word is simply a symbol for a picture in your mind. So maybe humans sort of picture things in their mind in a general way that's pretty uniform. Transmitting it, you know, breaking it down into a word and sending it around where somebody interprets that word, it's a crude way of communicating because perhaps, and many of us believe this, perhaps that we communicate at a much more fundamental level and the words are just part of that sort of illusion we function in the daily life. I think there's already that, and the science has shown that you can create even what we would call artificial telepathy has been created in a manner in which you can transfer thoughts from one person to another. You know, that's been demonstrated in a laboratory environment back as far as 1985. And the paper I have on this said that essentially what they did is they took two people that had, well, they took several people, but two people involved in the experiment at any given time were two, a transmitter and a receiver in rooms apart with electrical apparatus on each of their heads, one of them looking at the, you know, the cards that show you the triangles and the squares and the squiggly lines, and the other guy calling out what it was. And they were 100% accurate in eight different test subjects, you know, all the time. And it was a very clean transmittal of information wirelessly between two people. And what I would suggest is we probably already do that. In fact, I think we do that. But being able to demonstrate in the lab sort of validates the system, you know, being able to operate that way.
This would be a way of really proving psychic phenomena and producing psychic phenomena, really.
Well, and you think about it, you know, if you could actually create an environment where voluntarily you could get there. And, you know, that's part of, I think, the challenge in some of the sciences. I think we mimic what we already do, and we try and recreate what nature does by, you know, intervening. And that's just our, that's what humans do. That's what we do. That's our nature. But at the same time, you know, total transparency is a good thing, but on the other hand, it will require a great deal of forgiveness if we ever learn how to truly, literally read each other's minds. And when you look at hardware starting to show up, I would say that evolutionarily, humans aren't too far behind. In fact, a number of scientists that I was with a couple years ago, all sitting in the room together, and people that would never have talked about this, I don't think, in the open too much, were all saying the same thing, that we really thought that was the next evolution. In fact, the one guy that would say it openly and has and given the formulas for it is a guy named Alexander K. Varenin. And Alex was the former head of the biophysics lab for the USSR Academy of Sciences. For the last 10 years, there was one. And, you know, his work in this area to explain the unexplainable through mathematical formula and through physics is exceptional. And if people, you know, look for him out there in the Internet world, Alexander K. Varenin has published thousands of pages of data in these areas and others, pretty profound data, that provides those necessary models for engineers someday to recreate on a wider scale some of these ideas. And I think it's going to be interesting what happens in this next 20, 30 years, because that is where a lot of this technology is headed. And how we use it and how it benefits or destroys us will be our challenge.
Okay, because that was what I was thinking, that, you know, there are so many psychics out there who don't really realize how they are doing what they're doing. This is the way science is duplicating what the psychics are doing. Just using
in great measure, it's always been sort of people on the edge. But when you think about it, there's got to be an explanation for all this, and there is. It's just a matter of developing the science to interpret what's going on. And I think these are our natural attributes. I think we all have them. We just spend an awful lot of time sort of denying it and getting
true.
In the way of it.
Yeah, we try, you know, we keep saying, oh, it's only those few kooks that can do this, and it seems like it's getting now to where they're going to develop where it's going to be very possible for anyone, apparently. But I don't know how you feel about the ETs. You know, I've got a lot of work with them in my books, and that's how they communicate. It's not verbal. It's mind to mind. It's all mental communication.
Well, yeah, you know, I've heard that from all of you that research in those areas, and it makes perfect sense because it is, you know, it requires a different way of viewing the world. At the same time, it indicates more capacity in terms of managing, you know, what your reality is. I mean, I think that is how we communicate. On a very fundamental level, the words carry some message, but a lot of it is done on that subtle level. When you start to look at sort of where that science goes, I mean, think about this, on even a more on that same line is, there's a rule in physics that basically says that the observer, you and me, affect what we observe in terms of something being a particle or a wave, in other words, being solid,
you know,
or energy. At a very fundamental level.
I just finished reading that in a manuscript that I'm considering for publication. You picked up on that. I was just reading it before I made this call. That, yeah, it is definitely observed before it has an effect.
Yeah, and the fact of the matter is that we all create at that fundamental level according to the best physics minds in the world, which means on a real fundamental level, we participate in the very creation that we experience. And how we interpret that in the physical world through our, again, the sensors that allow us to get some resolution, our eyes, our nose, our ears, you know, all these things that are essentially interpreting vibratory motion, light, that's all it is when you're looking at objects, is how light is reflected and absorbed that you interpret it with your eyes. The sensors on the hands interpret temperature, and pressure, and, you know, I mean, you have all these basic senses, and the brain sort of puts it together and gives you an output. But the better our resolution, the better our output. So when man starts to make things allow us to see better, to go get our eyes fixed at the surgeon, I mean, mechanical kinds of things, that's one thing. But as our sensors increase, we can put special filters on our eyes, now we can see in the dark. You know, we can put special filters on our eyes, and we can do all kinds of things. These are extensions of our ability to perceive the reality around us, and I think that's what some people, we call them sensitives or psychics in the past, they just, you know, or shamans or any number of names, but the fact is they were people that could get a little better resolution without the hardware. And the hardware, which sort of anchors the general population's belief that these things are then possible, tend to gain the abilities as well. And so I think we're going to see, because we all have it. It's just a matter of suspending our beliefs long enough to recognize it. Sometimes it takes hardware to convince us we can do these things.
And enhancing it.
Yeah, exactly right.
That was another thing that Nostradamus saw, the computers going beyond the part with thought into what he called organic computers, which would be...
And this would be the living organisms, yeah.
Yeah, they said it would have the ability to replicate itself and repair itself.
Well, you know, there's some work that's been done on creating brain cells at the Salk Institute a number of years ago. In fact, in the book Earth Rising, the Revolution, we talked a little bit about this. And what was missing was to create the neurons, things that connect brain cells. And a few years later, the Salk Institute actually found a solution to that. So they could create not just the brain cells, but the neurons or the wiring that connects them together. And then they found out that they could actually fuse this kind of material onto electronic circuits. And so the building blocks have been around now about 8-9 years to create that kind of circuit. And then when you want to talk about quantum computing, the possibility increases dramatically. Because I think in organic kinds of computing systems like the human brain, you already have inherent in that is this kind of quantum computing capacity. I mean, just think about what I said earlier about how much computing power it takes just to measure in three dimensions what goes on in one neuron firing chain. It gives you some idea of the complexity of the entire human brain as it compares to that computer. We already are quantum computers. We're all walking around. We just haven't figured out how to get our circuits working in a more efficient way.
That's what they say. We only use 5% of our brains. But I was reading about this when I was researching organic computers, and they said in the future, the computer will be no more than like a bowl of water, that you wouldn't have to have the hardware or anything that we have today. because it would be a living thing. It would be an organic thing. I can't perceive that, but this is what they said was the way it's going.
Interesting. That's interesting. Yeah, it's interesting. You know, a lot of liquids, they say that they can hold memory. Maybe they become the memory circuits of the future. Who knows? But it is interesting because all of this is, again, where the sciences are sort of merging, where you have biological sciences and engineering and, you know, some of the hard earth sciences all coming together around common themes, and yet very, very different directions. And that's that convergence of technologies that I think is creating the super technologies of this century. And the things that are going to change, as much as everything changed when automobiles were invented and planes were invented over 100 years ago, we're going to see in even more dramatic terms in the next 10, 20 years, the same kind of magnitude of change.
It's all moving so much faster than we ever could have before. But also, you know, in my book, we didn't call it this, but I've got it down to now is nanotechnology. And you've probably studied that also, haven't you?
Yeah, and this is the idea of reducing things to a billionth size and the creating of small machines and mechanisms. And again, you know, nature does this already. I mean, on a cellular level, on a molecular level, when you start to think about how complicated the human machine is as an example or any other living organism. But again, the smaller you get, the more refined you get, the more sophisticated can you create. And we are crossing thresholds now. Nanotechnologies offer incredible possibilities in a lot of different areas, from material science to pharmaceuticals, to computing. And so on. Virtually every area ends up being impacted when you start to think about the applications of nanotechnologies. I mean, in pharmaceuticals, the reduction of particle size, as an example, allows something to cover a much larger surface area. So imagine, we actually developed some things along this line. We produced the blue-green algae in a -1 micron particle size, by running it through pharmaceutical mills, specialized mills, that allowed us to reduce particle size. And the idea was that you'd be able to intake this as a supplement, and then instead of the body working quite so hard to break it all down into fine components, a colloidal size, small size that can be easily absorbed, we did that work mechanically before the product was put in a package or put in a capsule. And, you know, in doing that, what happens is if you think about a cubic inch has got six surface areas that are an inch square piece. And so you got six surface inches it covers. But cut it into 1,000 slices and just measure the front and the back, and now you got 2,000 surface inches to cover. Cut it into 1,000,000 slices and you got 2,000,000 front and back. You know, so if you think about the smaller a particle gets, the bigger it spreads out and the more easily it is absorbed. So for pharmaceuticals, or for dietary supplements, this has huge potential.
Yeah, I know when I was researching this, they're talking about, like, even in the cellular level, putting, like, tiny machines that were on the size of the cell that could be injected into the body to do things.
Right, and exactly that. And then when you talk about nanotechnology, think about machines getting smarter and smaller. And, you know, really that's what have we watched happen all the way through our lives. We've gone from huge machines to accomplish greater and greater capacities. And the smaller you get, things operate a little differently when you get down to these sizes. So that comes into consideration. But whole new branches of science in the last 20 years have been created surrounding the exploration of nanotechnologies for microscopic machines, MIMS, or other applications of miniaturization or nanotechnologies.
Yeah, it is mind-boggling because, you know, when I was talking about these things. But, you know, also, I read somewhere, it's been a few years ago, that they were going to make telephones that'll be the size of a shirt button, and that these were in the works to be, they're being developed now. Of course, I was thinking you wouldn't want to get that lost in the washing machine, you know.
I think that's out there, but I think people have now looked at the phone now. It's a camera. It's a video machine. It's a computer. It's, you know, I mean, how many different functions do they get out of a handset? And I think that's more in the direction in which we're headed. True, we can get very small phones, but you still have to have, you know, some kind of a screen size if you're going to do all the things people are doing now with telephonic communication. And you think about the amount of material and information and flow that comes through one of these devices today and how much people rely on them. It's pretty amazing. I mean, I have a cell phone that I use only when I travel, and it has all these functions on it that I've never figured out. It's like the flashing VCR that we used to have in our living room before DVDs came out. Now we got a flashing DVD telling us what time it is, and it's always the same time. But the point is, you know, a lot of this technology, at least when I look at it, and I study these things, and, you know, I look at it and I say, you know, what am I trading off in exchange for this? And some things I'm not willing to trade off. You know, my personal privacy, my idea of driving down the road without the phone ringing and enjoying the drive somewhere. I mean, that's kind of a lost art these days. I still enjoy doing that because I don't have a cell phone that I use other than when I travel out of state so my family can get me. And they're the only ones with the number. And it makes life actually much simpler, and there's very few things that constitute an emergency. You know, I understand, you know, people have jobs that require it, but if we really ask ourselves in most cases, how much technology do we really need, and what are the trade-offs, more importantly, that we're willing to make? And I think in the course of that, some of these trade-offs don't have to be made at all. We just need to regulate the industries as they evolve to make sure the things that we value in common, personal privacy, liberty, our freedom to express ourselves without restraint, you know, unless we're trampling over someone else. I mean, those are things that we need to make sure are inherent in the use and development of technologies in this century. And I think that's really been more of my message in the last 15 years as I've looked at technology. It's not so much opposing them or supporting them. More importantly, making sure they support and don't oppose us, the creators of these very technologies.
Mm-hmm. Well, my phone is just a phone. I don't need one that takes pictures. I don't need one that texts. And I don't even have it on unless I'm going to use it for an emergency or something like that. So I'm still in the dark age, I guess.
Yeah, and I'm with you, Dolores, and some things, are, you know, they're not that important to me that they have to be in my face all the time. And, you know, and I think we need to think, all of us can think about that, and look at the amount of your budget that goes to things that we didn't even need 20 years ago, you know, and 20 years is not a very long time.
And that's when my first book came out, and, you know, it's like the developments are moving so fast, and we don't need these, but the kids today think they do. That's growing up with, you know.
Do you remember what a good thrill it was to write a book that you could actually move paragraphs around without having to retype the whole thing? I mean, that was remarkable.
It was big when I first got my first computer. I didn't have to type a whole page because I made a mistake.
I'll tell you a funny story. When one of my children was about five, they were surplusing a bunch of typewriters out of the school system, and he was looking at what these things look like, and he said, "Those will never work." He said, "There's no screen." and it is funny.
Another kid said, "Well, what do you do if you make a mistake? You know, they're so used to when they are." I wrote my first five books on a typewriter.
Yeah.
And that's all I knew, you know. But to me now, you know, I would never go back to doing that. I only use the typewriter to type envelopes or something. So we move on. That was a big advancement to go be able to write a book on a computer.
Well, and the voice recognition systems are now going to get, in the next couple of years, we're going to see them get much more sophisticated, where they will be able, with a lot more perfection, we'll be able to dictate material in a much more efficient way than we can now. The voice recognition trends are going to get much more intensified, to the point where language translation, you'll be able to pick up the phone and call somebody in Russia where you just came from, and they'll be able to talk to you in Russian, and you'll talk to them in English, and the translation will be made instantaneously and so perfectly that it'll be seamless. And we're going to be able to experience that in our lifetimes, as well as the command to computers being enhanced that much better. And that's going to be a phenomenal.
I'd appreciate that, because it made the lectures and my classes take twice as long when you have to go through a translator.
But just imagine, everybody have a headset and real-time translation, and we're not far away from that. And that is going to revolutionize people like you and me and others that are communicating ideas, and anyone that wants to communicate an idea in any language will have that capability. I mean, we want to make sure democracies and freedom are preserved in that kind of environment, because we're going to have some good ideas kicking around the planet.
You know, in my work, I have to transcribe tapes when I'm writing my books. And everybody, it takes all day to do one tape. I'm still using tape, not the digital. And it takes 30 pages of typing. And people said, well, you can do it with the voice recognition. It's not perfected. It will only recognize one voice. It won't recognize two. So it has a lot of things to be worked out yet.
Yeah, that's right. And it's going to be a few years away, but it's going to get very easy where it's, you know, people resist a lot of things in terms of technology, so it gets simple enough for us all to use it. And that's ultimately where the change will come in, is when the computing power is a little bit better, in fact, a lot better, we're going to see that. And it's going to happen relatively rapidly, just given the pace of change today. 3 to 5 years out, we're going to be using those systems very efficiently, and increasingly so. And I think then you're going to see that shift at the same time running parallel as neurosciences advance, where the idea of thought interface it becomes much more prevalent. Although we're already seeing it in military applications and for people that have physical or other impairments, we're starting to see some of that technology evolve. But it's, like you say, it's so it's directed, got to be trained for the person, for the individual, or for the computer to understand that person's voice. That's going to smooth out as the technology improves to the point where it won't matter.
Yeah, because it still has a lot of bugs to be worked out.
Yep.
I'm watching my clock. You know, we got to sign off at 5 till. We're almost there already. But
I know
it. It goes fast.
Zip by on us.
But one thing I wanted to ask you, if we can keep it within this 5 minutes, what about this super collider program I've been hearing about?
I've not followed that as much as others, and you know it's interesting because again it's pushing thresholds to gain new knowledge, and there's a lot. You know, it's like I remember when the big debate over atomic power. You know, are we going to rip the atmosphere right off the planet?
Yeah.
And it's the same kind of things that are being discussed here. And I think this is where big science should never be funded in secret. Those days are over, because big science today can ruin a planet, can damage lifestyles, can change the very essence of who we are. Whether it's the super collider, the HARP programs, or some of the more sinister science and mind effects that have been developed over the years, I think we need to take a new look at how these sciences are evolved, what kind of scrutiny they get, so that mistakes that we cannot recover from are not made. And we don't have those safeguards yet. And it's this generation that's going to have to make some of those decisions. Or the accidents that people predict, one day we will see those accidents or perhaps deliberate effects of abusive technology take place.
See, that's one thing I like about you, Nick, is because you have been blowing the whistle for years now, you know, letting people know about these things that are supposedly be hidden from people. And the information circuit out there is getting more and more. They can't hide these things anymore.
That's exactly it. And I can say that in the four books we have in print today, there's 1,600 reference sources, and these aren't phone calls in some clandestine place. These are public records, academic studies, military reports that get into the technologies, many of which we've touched on today. But I would encourage people to check out our books. They're all based on, you know, good science and good information. And when you're done with them, send them to someone else. Get that information out there. We appreciate it when people do that.
That's one thing I like, because you have always gone into a lot of detail in your research, and you make sure it's accurate before you write about it. Let's tell people the names of your books.
Sure. The books are Earth Rising, The Revolution, Angels Don't Play This Harp, Controlling the Human Mind, and Earth Rising 2. And they're in several languages. If you just do a search on those names, you'll find them, or check us out on our website.
Yep. You give out the website and how they can contact you.
Sure. The website is EarthPulse, EarthPulse, EarthPulse.com. Or you can call us toll-free at 866. I got to think about it now. Actually, I should give an international number, 907-249-9111. We'll get to it.
Say that number again.
907-249-9111, and that'll reach us.
Okay, and the website is earthpulse, all one word, .com.
Correct.
Okay, and so anybody who wants to get a hold of you, they can that way then.
Absolutely. And, you know, and there's a lot of material on our website. There's hundreds of pages of free material. There's a whole section on the mind effects, a whole section on HAARP. There's a lot of things in there on enhancing human performance through various tools and technologies. We just encourage people to check it out and enjoy the articles. There's a lot of material there, and most of it's free. There's several hundred hours of audio material on the website that is free, and there's some video material that's posted there as well.
Wow, because, you know, that's what I found. This show does go all over the world. And I didn't think so because I'm sitting here in my front room talking to the wall. But when I've gone to Australia and to even into Russia and to Italy, they say, we're listening to the show. So BBS Radio does go everywhere. So this is a good opportunity for anybody interested in this. They can go to your website and get lots of information.
Yeah, and we certainly appreciate the time with you today, Dolores. I know you're traveling around. I used to travel a lot more than I do these days. I've kind of decided to stop lecturing and stay close to home and try and do a little bit more radio and spend a little more time in Alaska. So I'll see you, though, I'm sure, from time to time when I do get out and lecture. I know that seems to be the only time that we ever get to have a meeting is is when you and I are in the same venue.
Yeah, because I'm still traveling. I'm traveling more. They're wanting me to come back to Russia at least two or three times a year now. So there's a lot going on the parts of the world, and I'll be going for the first time to South Africa this year, too. So I haven't slowed down yet anyway.
No. You know, it's funny. I think we all go through cycles, and there's a time when maybe a little less lecturing, a little more radio, and a little more contemplation. And you know, traveling, I always enjoyed it, but it's always good to get back home. And I know you've been traveling quite a bit, Russia, and then you said you were out shooting some film in Boston.
Yeah.
You know, that's always, I always enjoyed some of that. In fact, there's some segments we did for History Channel that'll be airing sometime this summer. We did three different segments for them, one on HAARP, one on mind effects, and one on DNA. So watch for those.
Uh-huh.
We'll be able to
look for you on the History Channel then.
That's it.
Okay. Well, it's been wonderful having you on, and you always have plenty of information. And
we'll do it again more, maybe a little more often, and we're always glad to be on with you.
Okay, and maybe even though you're sitting there in Alaska, you're still doing your research and you're finding out more information.
You bet.
And that's very, very, very important. So thanks, Nick, for coming on tonight.
Well, thanks for having me, and my best to your listening audience.
Okay. All right. Good night, everyone.